The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
In Mark 10, verse 29, Jesus said this, "Truly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or farms for my sake and for the gospel's sake, but that he shall receive 100 times as much now in the present age, houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, and farms, along with persecutions, and in the age to come eternal life." That's an astonishing promise, and perhaps the thing about that promise that we can most readily identify with and see empirically fulfilled in the life of the church is the last part. We don't see in our experience very much the 100 times now of the things we've given up, but we do see throughout the history of the church a continual pattern of persecution. Jesus promised persecutions to his church, and Jesus always keeps his promises, and this one no less than any other. The church is always a church under the cross. That doesn't mean that the church is not also victorious in a very important sense, but the church has been and continues to be persecuted and opposed by the world. One of the ways that the church is persecuted by the world is that the world lies about the nature of the church and what the church intends to do. The world always lies about what we're about, and the world always slanders the church. That's a continual phenomenon in the history of the church. But although slander is a continuous phenomenon, the specific slanders change, and they vary from age to age. And I think it's helpful for us to look at the slanders, the lies that are told about the church, as a means of examining ourselves, as examining the Christian church, and how it's presenting itself in the world, the face that it's showing, if you will, in the world, the public presence of the church. I think today, the most popular slander against evangelical Christians, particularly those who are very active in the political arena, is that they're all fascists. They're totalitarians. They're trying to stuff Christianity down everybody else's throats and impose morality and cut off from the land everyone who opposes them. That's a lie. But I think it tells us something important about how the church is presenting herself in the world, that this is the particular lie that the world is telling about Christians today. I think what it indicates, and I think there's other evidence for this, but I think what it indicates, it's a sign of the fact that when the Christian enters the public arena today, he enters the public arena as a political actor. The public presence of the church is a political presence. Christians have entered into the public arena with great energy over the last 25 or 30 years and accomplished a great deal of things in that arena. And that's the way the world perceives the church, as just another interest group. But it tells us something important about how the church is entering the public arena and how the church is encountering and taking a stance over against the world. This is not the slander that was told in the early church. And by early church, I'm talking post-apostolic, the first couple centuries after the New Testament period. It was still slander against the church, but it's a different slander. There are three things that the Romans accused the Christians of, the lies that they told about the Christians. The first was, and you see, read the apologists of the early church, and you find that these are the things that they're constantly having to refute. These are the charges that they have to refute. The first is that Christians are cannibals. And the second is that Christians are guilty of incest. And the third is that they're atheists. They're cannibals because they partake of the body and blood of Christ. They're guilty of incest because they greet one another with a holy kiss, and they call one another brothers and sisters. and they're atheists because they don't accept the gods and goddesses of the Roman pantheon, or and also they would not accept, were not willing to sacrifice to the genius of the emperor, of the Roman emperor. That's a very different kind of lie. It's still a lie, but it's a very different kind. And I think what it tells us about the public presence of the church in the second and third century is that it was not a political presence. If a pagan Roman knew anything about the church at all, what he knew was not that the church is trying to take over the political system of Rome. What he knew was the church is a liturgical community, a community of worship. That's where the charges come from. That's where the lies come from. The public presence of the church was the presence of a community that worships at the table of the Lord and partakes of the body and blood of Christ, that in its worship at the table of the Lord embraces one another with a holy kiss. And even the issue where it comes up directly against the Roman political system on the issue of idolatry and sacrificing to the emperor is still an issue of worship. Christians were known by their worship. That was the public face that they presented to the world in that century. As I say, the Romans, like non-Christian opponents of the church today, lied about the church, but the lie is significantly different. And in my mind, at least, we will be redressing the balance, and I hope I can indicate why I'm saying this. The church will become more balanced, will have become more balanced, when the slander goes back to one of cannibalism. I'm looking forward to the day when we're called cannibals again, okay? Because that will say something about what kind of people we are, okay? I'm not at all, and I hope nothing I say today is taken as condemning Christian political activity. I certainly don't want to say that. But I think that the first public presence of the church is a presence in worship at the Lord's table and in fellowship with one another. Another way to say the same thing is that Christians have been busy for the last several decades making efforts of various kinds to Christianize America, whatever that might mean, and it means a number of different things to different people. But to make America more Christian, and I think those are laudable efforts and have been successful in remarkable ways that we could not have anticipated 20 or 25 years ago. But in that laudable effort to Christianize the nation, I think Christians have failed to recognize that the first step is to Christianize the church, to make sure the church is operating according to Christian standards. And that's where I want to focus my attention. And I hope what I say is spiritual, that it's spiritual wisdom. Therefore, we're talking about the spirituality of the church. I want to approach this by thinking about the question of how Christianity is related to culture. And I'm using culture here in the expansive anthropological sense that is probably the most common usage of the word today. A culture simply refers to the way of life of a particular people and includes all their institutions, all their habits, all their worldview, but it describes the full way of life. It's not one sector, like we think of high culture as being one sector of cultural life. In the anthropological sense, we're talking about the whole way of life of a particular group. And that group can be large or smaller. It can be an entire nation. There can be a national culture. There's corporate culture. There's academic culture. There's a way of life of a particular group of people overlapping and interacting in infinitely complex ways. But that's how I'm using the term culture. How does Christianity relate to this complex set of realities? Well, there are several ways to answer this, and what I'm saying here, I concede, and I was had to concede again and again in the morning session, is oversimplified. I don't know any other way to approach questions that are almost infinitely complex without oversimplifying. But there are, I would say that there are several ways that Christians have approached this issue, and to make it easier for me to deal with, if not for you, I'm going to draw pictures of these different ways. One way to think about the church's relation to culture is to think about it as a conflict of worldviews or ideas. That's a Bible. And the sea represents the culture outside the church. And in this way of thinking about this question, it's mainly a battle of worldviews. The Bible presents to us a particular view of man, a particular view of God, particular view of history, and this worldview is in conflict with the ideas and the worldview outside the church. And that's true. There is a conflict of worldview. There is a conflict of ideas, and ideas have consequences. But that's not all we need to say about the relation of Christianity and culture, because it's not just ideas that are at stake. We can just look at the issues that confront us in America today. Abortion is not just, obviously, a question of ideas. There are ideas involved with it. There are bad ideas that have led to the institutionalization of abortion and been reinforced by the institutionalization of abortion. But it's not just the conflict of ideas, is it? It's about people and what they do. And we can't reduce, nor can we reduce Christianity to just an ideology, just a system of ideas. So this conflict of worldviews is true, but it doesn't get everything we want to say. Another way to frame the question is to think about the individual Christians. Ooh, that's even worse than this morning. The individual Christian's relation. This is an individual Christian, kind of Gumby-like. The individual Christian's relation to the culture around him. And we're all involved with the culture in the world outside the church in various ways, in our work, in various kinds of voluntary societies, in our neighborhoods and so forth. And we can think about how we relate as individual Christians and interact with our culture. And this is important and true. We all bear individual responsibility for what we do and how we relate to the world around us. But again, this is not all we need to say, because we're not just individuals, and we're all complicated in a complicated way, intertwined with other people. When a breadwinner goes to work, he's not just going as an individual into that setting. He's going as the head of a family. And what he does in that work setting is influenced by his relations with his family. We're never quite alone, are we? From the beginning of life to the end of life, we're never quite alone. And so to think purely in individualistic terms is just too simplistic. It doesn't get to the reality of what we want to deal with. It's not just individuals in relation to the culture around us. Another way to think about the role of the church specifically in a system is to think in terms of the church as a mediating institution, what sociologists call a mediating institution. I would diagram this as, this is a more political way of thinking about the question. We can diagram it like this. There's the state, and there's the individual. And the state, in a totalitarian, even a totalitarian democratic system, directly impinges on the life of the individual. And freedom is created, and freedom is secured and promoted by the promotion of mediating institutions, so that there's something between the individual and the state that protects the individual from the direct oversight and control by an impersonal bureaucratic state. So we have neighborhoods and voluntary organizations, families, businesses, various kinds of institutions, and then there's the church. And the church is one of many mediating institutions that helps to soften the impact of a bureaucratic, impersonal state on individual lives. And again, there's truth in that. The church can and does play that role. And it's important, certainly, that Christians advocate a decentralized system of power. That's basic, I think, to Christianity, is to say that the state is not absolute. But I don't want to say that all the church is a mediating institution on the same level as these other institutions. That may be true in a sociological sense, but that's not all we need to say about the church, according to the scriptural information and revelation that we have. To answer this question about how Christianity relates to culture, it's helpful to me to think about it in the terms that I'm going to describe it to you in the next few minutes. And let me say another qualification, what I'm proposing here, I don't pretend to be a final word on the question of how Christianity relates to culture. I think Father Newhouse was quite correct last night to say that we should beware of the temptation, that it is a temptation to say we've got it all wrapped up. We know how it works now, and we don't have to think about it anymore. What I'm suggesting is just something that's been a helpful way to me, for me to think through these issues, and I present it to you for your reflection. But I think we can get at an answer to the question of how Christianity relates to culture by looking at how the New Testament church understood herself in relation to the world around it, and specifically by looking at how the church was the ecclesia of God. Ecclesia, of course, is the Greek word that stands behind the word church in the New Testament normally. Very commonly, this is given an etymological interpretation. It's broken up into the two component words. Ek is the preposition out of. Ecclesia comes from a form of word group that means call, and so the ecclesia are those who are called out from the world to be a separate people. And that's true. The church is made up of those who are called out, and the church is to be a separate people, and I hope that's clear in what I say. But that's not what the word means. And Dr. Sylvain Poythress will tell you at great length that we can't base our understanding of particular words on the etymology of the word. That instead we have to look at the usage. And the way the Greek word ekklesia is used in the Greek world in which the church was first introduced is simply as an assembly. Of course, an assembly might have been called out from elsewhere, but the idea of calling out is not part of the usage of the word. Instead, it simply means assembly. And there are two basic uses of the Greek word that the New Testament writers reflect. One is the secular Greek usage, where ekklesia refers to the assembly of male citizens of a Greek polis, or city-state. When Aristotle says that in a democratic system, the assembly of citizens should have sovereign power, he uses the word ekklesia. The citizens were the men of the city-state, normally those who had some stake in the religious institutions and the religious worship of the city-state, but it's not necessarily a religious assembly. The ecclesia is not necessarily a gathering for worship. It's a gathering normally to deliberate on the issues and questions that face the city-state. If there's war threatening, for example, the ecclesia would gather to deliberate about how to respond to the threat of war. If there's a proposal for a new building project in the Acropolis, the ecclesia would gather to deliberate on that. And the ecclesia is not just, one of the points I want to make here is that the ecclesia is not just one institution within the polis, but instead it's the entire polis representatively assembled in its citizens. The other usage that enters into the New Testament usage is that of the Septuagint, the Old Testament Greek translation of the Bible. And in the Septuagint, ekklesia is used to refer to the assembly of Israel. When Israel comes to Mount Sinai, they are the assembly of God, the ekklesia of Jehovah. In 1 Kings 8, when the Israelites gather to dedicate the temple, again, the word ekklesia is used in the Septuagint. And I think scholars would generally recognize that this is the source, the Septuagint usage is the source, main source of the New Testament usage of ekklesia. So when the New Testament writers say this is the ekklesia, that we are the ekklesia of God, what they're saying in that context is we are the true assembly of God. We are the true Israel of God. But there is one place in the New Testament, and I believe it's the only place in the New Testament where the word ekklesia is used in its classical Greek secular sense, and that's in Acts 19. Excuse me. Acts 19, I won't take time to look at this in great length, but just to say that I just remind you of the background here. Paul is in Ephesus, and he's had some success in winning converts, and that success has threatened the industry of Demetrius the silversmith because he's in the business of making shrines, model shrines for Artemis of the Ephesians. And so he stirs up the people against Paul and against Paul's companions, and there's a riot in Ephesus on account of this. They drag Paul's companions into the theater, and then they come together, and this is the description that Luke gives in Acts 19:31. Also, some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of Paul's, sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. So then, some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what cause they had come together. And then on down later, the town clerk gets up, and he's recognizes that this is not really a lawful assembly. This is not the way we should behave in our ecclesia, and so he dismisses them and says, "If you have any real business to bring against Paul, you'll have to do it when in a more orderly manner." F.F. Bruce, commenting on this passage, suggests, and I think rightly, that Luke is using the word ecclesia in verse 32 ironically. This is, in fact, Luke's only portrait of the Greek ecclesia in action. And it's not a pretty picture, is it? What does the Greek ecclesia look like? How does the Greek polis operate? At least in this passage, it's not a deliberative assembly. It's a place where people come together and are so confused they don't know why they're there. When somebody tries to speak, they shout them down, and they spend 2 hours shouting, "Great is Artemis the Ephesians." And this is the only portrait in the book of Acts that we have of the workings of the ecclesia. Of course, we have other portraits of Greeks in Athens, a little bit more positive, somewhat more positive. But this is the only picture we have of the ecclesia in action. And I think Luke is very deliberately saying, you know, here's the Greek ecclesia at work. But this is not the only riot in the book of Acts. There's another riot a couple of chapters later. And if you read through Acts 19 and read along with that, Acts 21, 27 and following, you'll see continual links between these passages. The same language is used in both cases. The people rush together. In both cases, people are dragged. In both cases, people are shouting so that they can't understand each other. But in Acts 21, it's not Greeks. It's not the Greek ecclesia that's acting this way. It's not the Greek ecclesia that's a place of confusion and violence. This riot is taking place in Jerusalem. And the people who are doing this are the Jews who have rejected Paul and his gospel. We have two ecclesia presented here. And Luke, very deliberately connects the two by the way he writes these two accounts. They're very similar to each other. They look the same. The Greek ecclesia and the Jewish ecclesia, although the word ecclesia isn't used in chapter 21, but it is a gathering, they look the same. They do the same kinds of things. But of course, the book of Acts also presents us with the portrait of another gathering, another assembly, another ecclesia, where people don't gather to break heads, but gather to break bread. Okay. In chapter 21, verses 7 and following, in between these two portraits, in between the portrait of the Ephesian ecclesia and the Jerusalem assembly, we have a portrait of the Christian ecclesia. And the Christian ecclesia is a place where the people gather knowing why they're there. They gather to break bread. They don't shout Paul down, even though he goes on past midnight. And see, the way that Luke has written the account in Acts, it's very striking how these two gatherings are contrasted with each other. And this ecclesia is a place where the dead are raised. Eutychus, of course, falls out the window and Paul raises him up. The point I want to make with all this, and there's more we could say about those contrasts, I think it's there in the text that Luke is making kind of giving a comic portrait of the ecclesia of the Greeks. But the point I want to make in this is what the way the Christians perceived themselves was as an alternative ecclesia. And again, I remind you that as I understand the usage of the term, ecclesia is not simply one institution within the polis, but it's the whole polis representatively assembled. Let me draw another picture and try to explain what I'm saying. Let's say that circle represents the Greek city-state or the Roman world. We have various kinds of institutions that are part of that. What the Christians are not saying is we're part of this pie. We fit in this section, but this is okay in general. We're just part of this. No. What the Christians are saying by calling themselves ecclesia, by the way Luke portrays the contrasting assemblies, what the Christians are saying is, we're an alternative to this entire world. Okay. This is one way of ordering human life. The church is another way of ordering human life, created by the Spirit, brought together by the call of the gospel. But it's another alternative way of ordering human life. It's an alternative city, and not just one sector of the city. Okay? And I think we could think about this in terms of the eschatological understanding of the church in the New Testament, that the church is the first fruits of a new creation, of a new ordering of life, of a new ordering of the creation. It's not just fitting into the religious dimension of an existing order that's okay. It's proposing an alternative to the whole. Now, in this, so to put it into our terms that we started with, how does Christianity relate to culture? I would say that a helpful way to look at it would be this, that the Christian church relates to culture as a distinct culture, as a group of people with a distinct way of life. Now, this is one of the places where I'm oversimplifying radically, because, of course, we share in many ways with the cultures of which we're part. If we're Americans, we share in that culture. We share in that way of life. But in important ways, as I hope to show as we go through, the church is a distinct culture. It's a people with a distinct way of life, and it confronts the world as a culture outside itself. And the mission of the church in this model is twofold. First of all, the church is to maintain its distinctiveness. If it's going to be, if it's going to look just like the Ephesian assembly in Acts 19, then it's not going to be an alternative, is it? It's supposed to be different, so that its very life, not just what it says and what it proclaims, but the very life of the church is an alternative to the life and the organization of human life in the world outside. Okay. The church must maintain its distinctiveness, or else it has nothing, you know, it's just going to be a reflection of the world. The boundaries that surround the church are not infinitely permeable. David Wells has written a couple of books on the worldliness of the evangelical churches today, and I think that he's right on target with that. The problem is that the direction of influence is going the other way, that the world is remaking the church into its image. The church must maintain these boundaries and be distinct. But at the same time, I'm not an Anabaptist, and the church's mission is not just to maintain its distinctiveness and just, you know, withdraw, but the church also has a mission to seek to have the culture that exists in the church, the way of life that exists in the church, become incarnated in some way in the world outside. This is not a utopian kind of program. This is not a utopian kind of mission. In fact, this is exactly what the Christian church has done. The Bible has been the basis of law in Western history. The Bible has been at the core of Western literature since the early centuries of the church. And so it's not a utopian vision to say that the church is seeking to see the culture that exists within it become real in some way outside in the world, but always remembering that the church is this separate people. Okay, the world and the church until the eschaton never totally coincide with each other. And yet the church seeks to remake the world into something like the kingdom of God, even though we know that the kingdom of God will never come short of Jesus' return. Now, let me cite, I think it's original with Richard John Newhouse, but his, I don't know if it is or not, but a little phrase that he uses frequently is that the church stands against the world for the world. I think that's a summary of the mission of the church. We must stand against the world, but it's not to retreat into our own little ghettos. We stand against the world in order that we can propose an alternative to the ordering of human life that we find outside the church. Well, how is the church a culture? I'm going to spend the rest of the time I have discussing that, and I'm going to discuss it using what are traditionally called the marks of the church. After the Reformation broke up the unity of the Catholic Church, the governmental unity of the Catholic Church, there was a great problem with deciding which communities were true churches and which were not. And the reformers and the post-Reformation theologians developed a standards for evaluating what's a true church and what's not. And the most popular formulation of this, there are many formulations. In fact, I think there were the Roman Catholics had the same problem, of course. There was some Roman Catholic who came up with 100 or so marks of the true church. The reformers post-Reformation came up with 3, and this is the most popular way of formulating this question. That is, the true church is distinct by its faithful proclamation and adherence to the Word, by its performance of the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper, and by the exercise of discipline, word, sacrament, and discipline. The origination of this trinity of marks of the church is dealing with the question of a true and false church. I want to use the same categories to discuss how the church is a distinct culture over against the world. So I'm not going to be talking about true and false churches. I'm going to be talking about what distinguishes the church as a way of life, as a people with a particular way of life, from the world outside the church. And the church is distinct from the world in terms of word, sacrament, and discipline. By saying that the church is distinct in terms of the word, I'm saying that the church has its own language, its own way of labeling reality, its own names that it gives to the world based on the scripture, not woodenly parroting scripture. We're recreatively reconstructive, as Van Til said. We don't have to simply repeat what the Bible says. If I believe that, I wouldn't be speaking, I would be reading. And yet, our language that we use should be based on the Word, should grow out of the Word, and we should give biblically based and biblical names to what we find in the world. Another way in which the Word distinguishes the church, and I'll fill these out as we go through. I'm just giving you an overview of where I'm headed. The church is distinct in terms of the Word, not only by its vocabulary, but also by the narrative or the story that it lives out, that by which it identifies itself. Dr. Brown has just reminded us just a few moments ago in the plenary session that we must insist that the story is a true story. But yet it's a story, and we want to think about how the story contributes a distinct way of life to the distinct way of life of the church. Secondly, the church is distinct in terms of the word. The church is distinct in terms of sacrament. By this I mean that the church has its own distinct rites that embody its own view of the world and its own aspirations. That these rites, R-I-T-E-S, by the rites I'm talking about the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper, these rites express the kind of people we aspire to be. They tell us something about who we're supposed to be. And we'll look at how that's the case in a few minutes. And thirdly, the church is distinct from the world in terms of its discipline. That is, in terms of the moral standards by which it lives and in terms of the way that it enforces those moral standards. The church has its own governance, its own way of enforcing those moral boundaries. So, word, sacrament, and discipline. The church is distinct, first of all, from the world in terms of the word. And this, obviously, is something that distinguishes cultures from one another. There can hardly be a distinct culture without common language. A culture is, as I've said, is the common way of life of a group of people. And if we can't talk to each other and communicate with each other, we can't have a common way of life. But not only that, but in important ways, I think language shapes the way we perceive reality. I think there's a close link between the way what we speak, not necessarily a one-to-one kind of link, but there's a close link between the way we speak and our language and the way we live and the way we view the world. So cultures in general are distinguished by language. And if the church is a separate culture, then one would expect the church to have a distinct language, to speak differently. Was this true? In one sense, in the most obvious sense perhaps, it's not true. The church speaks with many languages. The church is Pentecostal. And properly so, obviously. That's God's intention, that the Bible be translated into hundreds of languages, that every tongue and every race should confess Jesus Christ as Lord. So in one sense, we can't say that the church is a language group in the linguistic, grammatical kind of sense, the normal sense of the word language. But in another and very important sense, I think we need to say that the church does speak a different language from the world. And for me, it's easiest to think about this if we put ourselves in a missionary situation and think about what a missionary confronts. When a missionary moves into a new culture where the gospel has never been preached, there's an existing language there. There's an existing way of naming the what's in the world. And one of the things that a missionary does, certainly when he goes into that situation, is to try to learn that language so he can communicate with them. But at the same time, and just as importantly, the church comes in with its own language and its own way of naming things. And the church must seek to convince this culture that the church's language is the true one. A couple of examples. Don Richardson wrote a fairly famous mission book called Peace Child. And in that book, he tells about his experience among a group in New Guinea. When he first told the gospel story to this tribe in New Guinea, their first response was to think that Judas was the hero of the gospel story. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about this. For those of you who haven't, let me tell you why that's the case. In this particular tribe, the most clever, the funniest thing you could do, the thing by the way you acquired honor and respect from your peers, was by befriending someone in a neighboring tribe, winning their confidence and trust, and then inviting them over to your hut, sitting them down to the table, and then while they're eating your food, you fall on them and beat them to a pulp. That was great. That showed great prowess. And Richardson, of course, comes in there, and he preaches the gospel, and they say, Judas is our kind of guy. He's acting just like we do. But Richardson, see, had to come in and find out this particular label. You know, this is fun, or this is a way of acquiring honor and respect. And Richardson says, no, let me give the real label to that. That's treachery. So he's proposing another language for that practice. That's treachery. That's evil. That's forbidden. Okay. Or another example, Boniface, the apostle to the Saxons. Boniface had a very direct mission, missiological method. He would go into the Saxon communities, and he would go to the sacred oak where the Saxons would worship, and he'd go right up to the central tree. And this is according to legend. I don't know if it's true or not, but he'd go up to the sacred tree, the one in the center of the grove, the axis mundi, the center of the world, and all the Saxons would say, "You can't touch that. If you touch that, Wodan's going to get you, or Thor's going to get you. If you cut that down, you're going to be zapped." That's Wodan's sacred oak. And Boniface said, no, that's not Wodan's sacred oak. I've got a new name for it. That's kindling. And he would chop it down, and he would be fine. He's giving a new label to the institution and to what he finds in this culture. He's giving a new language, proposing a new language. Even when the church doesn't give new labels to things, the church fills existing labels and existing terms with a new meaning. This is true all over the New Testament. Where Paul takes terms and phrases, words that the Jews constantly used. We are the seed of Abraham, say the Jews. But Paul says, no, you're not. A seed of Abraham is not dependent on blood. The seed of Abraham is Jesus Christ, first of all, and those who have faith in him who have the faith of Abraham. The Jews say, we are the true Jews. And Paul says, no, you're not. Those who are inwardly Jews are the true Jews. He's filling these terms with new meaning in the light of God's work in Christ. He gives new meaning to the existing terms. And today, obviously, a lot of what we face as Christians in our what are called culture wars are debates about what we call things. And it's a mistake for us to think of that these are just, you know, kind of off to the side, that the real debate is about substance and the debate about terminology is symbolic. But the way we frame the debate and the language that we use in the debate has everything to do with the conclusions that we're going to come to. Once you say, and once you become convinced that the unborn child is just a blob of tissue, then it's very logical to say, well, the woman has a right to eliminate a blob of tissue if it's going to interfere with her life, if it's going to reduce her quality of life. So you need to, if you start on the other hand with the by calling that a baby, an unborn child, an innocent child, the debate is framed in a completely different direction. You really can't separate the form of the debate from the substance of the debate. And the same thing is true, I think, in the debates about homosexuality. We need to say, this is not an alternative lifestyle. We must apply God's standards and God's labels to it. And it's an abomination before the Lord. So a Christian church is to be distinct because it speaks a distinct language. William Willimon, who's the dean of the chapel, I guess, at Duke University, says that Christian pastors speak funny. And I would say, I would just generalize that and say Christians speak funny. Christians are supposed to talk funny. Not that we're completely speaking a completely different language, not that we make no effort to make ourselves understood, but yet there is a sense in which we're speaking a different language from what the world is speaking. And this is part of what it means to be a distinct people. Well, do Christians do this? In some cases and on some issues, yes. But in large measure, I think we don't speak Christianly. We don't Christian labels for things. We don't think in terms of, hey, this is God's inerrant word, and they don't know the Ten Commandments. Or the similarly low percentage of evangelical Christians who can't tell you who preached the Sermon on the Mount. Okay. I'm sure you're familiar with these kind of statistics and surveys. The level of Bible knowledge in churches that believe the Bible, much less liberal churches that believe the Bible, is appallingly low. Perhaps not much better than what was true before the Reformation. So Christians don't know the Bible, which is the source of our Christian language. We're not going to be able to speak Christianly, and we're not going to be able to look at the world Christianly. And this is a plea, certainly, for biblically based preaching and teaching and in-depth biblical preaching and teaching. But it's also, in my mind, a plea for a re-evaluation of traditional forms of liturgical worship in the church. And let me defend that by saying, by asking you the question, if you've learned another language, how did you learn it? Did you learn that language by listening to someone talk about it? Well, that's part of learning another language, but it doesn't stick very well with most of us if that's all we do. The way we learn another language is by repetition, by saying amo, amas, amat, and so forth over and over again, by doing the paradigms, by knocking it into our heads. That's the way it becomes part of us and becomes something that we can use. The way we learn language is by dry rote. That's one of the main criticisms of liturgical worship by many evangelicals. I find it one of the strengths of liturgical worship because we're learning biblical language, and the only way to do that is by saying it. And I'm talking about things like, for example, the Ten Commandments. If a church said the Ten Commandments every week in its worship, its members would know the Ten Commandments, right? If the church did responsive reading of the Psalms, the church would know the Psalms. The Psalms are a particularly important point here, I think, because as Calvin said, I don't have an exact quotation, but something like this, the Psalms are a textbook of the human soul, a virtual textbook of the human soul. The Psalms give us words by which we can grapple with the whole range of experience that we face as Christians. We learn to give words to experiences like abandonment by God. You know, we all have that sense sometimes, but the Psalms tell us how to pray in those situations. And it's not enough just to read the Psalms. We need to know them. And this has been true from the very beginning of the church, that the Psalms have been the foundation of Christian worship and Christian hymnody. Long before the Reformation, in monasteries all over Europe, monks were going through the entire Psalter every week. They knew those Psalms. And because they knew those Psalms, they had Christian language, biblical language, by which to evaluate and to order their experience. And I think in many respects, contemporary hymnody comes far short of that. And, I not made a study of this, but I suppose I would want to say, too, that even something like 19th century hymnody comes far short of this. 19th century revival hymns come far short of giving us, embracing the whole of Christian experience. Do we ever sing, for example, "And my God, why have you forsaken me? My soul is in despair. Do not be in despair, O my soul." Do we ever sing things like, as Psalm 83 says, "Make them like Midian, like Jabin's army. Make them like Sisera. Make them like dung upon the ground when the church is being persecuted." That's the way the Psalms teach us to pray. That's the way the Psalms teach us to... The Psalms form our piety, form how we approach God. And hymnody does too, the hymnody that we use today, but I think it doesn't grasp the full realm, the full scope of Christian experience. And what happens, I think, then is that we find other ways to explain our experience, other languages in which to evaluate our experience, whether psychological languages or something else. Some other way of looking at things fills the vacuum if we don't have a Christian way of evaluating and dealing with our experience. So the church is a distinct people in the fact that it is marked by the word. It has a distinct vocabulary. The church also has an identity that is shaped by a distinct story, a distinct narrative. And again, I want to insist that the story is true. And yet it is a story. It's a historical narrative that gives us an identity. We can begin to think about this just by thinking in simple individual terms. If you go to a party or to a wedding reception and you meet someone for the first time and you say, "Well, tell me about yourself." And you get a response like, "Well, I'm 6 feet four, I weigh 220 pounds, I have an unsightly mole on the middle of my back, I have 8% body fat, my social security number is..." Okay, you don't want name, rank, and serial number, do you? That doesn't tell you anything about who this person is. What are we anticipating when we say, "Tell me about yourself"? We're looking for a set of stories. We're looking for a narrative. That's how we identify ourselves. That's how we have continuity through time. We are the people that has lived this particular story. We do that individually. That's how we have an identity. And that's true not only of individuals, but of groups and cultures. Mario Vargas Llosa, a Peruvian novelist and a one-time presidential candidate of Peru, in one of his novels tells the story of the Machiguenga people in the Peruvian rainforest. And this is a people that, a tribe that is not geographically unified. In fact, they're scattered all over the rainforest. And they may meet together occasionally, maybe once a year for some special occasion, but generally they never see each other. And yet they have a strong sense of being part of the same tribe. And the reason for that is because of the storyteller. There's one member of the tribe goes from one sub-tribe to the other, and everywhere he goes, he tells the legends and the myths that tell of the ancestors of this tribe. They're a unified people because they share this past, and they share these stories. We are the people who have experienced this. We're the people who related to this particular ancestor. That's true of America, I think we could say. What makes one American, it's not race, certainly. It's not geographic location. I think in large part it's a matter of being part of a narrative, being able to tell the same story about ourselves. And the same is true of the Christian church. We have a distinct story that gives us an identity, that tells us about history, that gives us a particular view of history, of the past, of our past, and also of the past of the world. And to maintain this, our distinct identity, we need to maintain the distinctiveness and the oddness of the story that we tell, the story that we tell about ourselves and about the world. Okay, it's the story I'm thinking of is a story that we say in the Creed. There's sin, and then God sends a Savior. And we are part of that unfolding salvation that Jesus secured for us. But in order to maintain ourselves as a distinct people with a distinct identity, we need to maintain the distinctiveness of our narrative, of our story. We can't allow the story of the church to be subordinated to the story of America or to the story of the growth of democratic freedoms. Let me put it this way. I hope this makes my point. The question that we have to propose, or what we have to say as the church, is that the church is not one chapter. The story of the church is not one chapter in the unfolding narrative of freedom and democracy. The unfolding of freedom and democracy is a chapter in the history of the church. The big story is the story that tells of the unfolding of God's grace in Jesus Christ, and that story is focused in the church. That's the big story. And whatever other stories that intersect in our lives, the American story, our main identity as a people has to come from that big story. And again, worship, I think, is key in shaping us by this narrative. In worship, we not only learn a new language, but we also are reminded of our history. Worship is a renewal of the covenant. And whenever God renews his covenant and makes a covenant with his people, he begins by telling stories. He begins by reminding them of what he's done. The Ten Commandments don't begin, "Thou shalt not." The Ten Commandments begin with God's reminder of what he's done in the past, with a story. "I'm the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now do this," or rather, "don't do this." But part of our worship, it's not just the do's and don'ts, but a main part of our worship is memorializing this history so that it becomes the atmosphere in which we live and move and have our being. Let me give just kind of a test for which story is defining our churches. And I don't want to get into the debate about the suitability of holidays in the church, celebration of particular holidays other than the Sabbath. But let me just ask this question. If Pentecost and Mother's Day fall on the same day, which gets the sermon in your church? I think that may tell us something about which story is the dominant story. Which history are we memorializing? Which is the bigger, which gets the bigger play in your church, the 4th of July or Ascension Day? I'm not anti-American by any means, but I think as Christians we have to say that Ascension Day is vastly, vastly more important in the history of the world as well as in the history of the church. And we have to ask ourselves whether we're reflecting the relative importance of those two events in our life as churches. Okay, I need to move on to sacraments. The church is a distinct people in that it is distinguished by the word, by its language, and by the narrative that it lives out. The church is also distinguished from the world by its rites, R-I-T-E-S, and again, I'm going to use rites and sacraments interchangeably. In the Reformed tradition, generally, sacraments are called signs and seals rather than rites. I think rite is a perfectly good term to describe the sacraments. After all, sacraments are something that involves an action. We tend to think of signs as something that we simply look at, that's presented before us, but the sacraments are things that we do that involve, you know, it's not just water that makes baptism, it's sprinkling of water on a person. It's not just bread and wine that makes the Lord's Supper. It's eating bread and wine with one another. So rites, I think, captures that active aspect of the sacraments perhaps better than the traditional Reformed language, although I certainly don't reject that language and those terms. Well, anthropologists and sociologists will tell you that a culture is distinguished not only by its language, but also by its rites, its rituals, and its ceremonies. If we can use ritual in a real expansive sense to include things like the way we greet one another or the way we leave one another, then we can see that there are different cultures are distinguished in part by the rituals that they have, by those kinds of gestures. In the United States, when two men meet each other, even if they just met each other yesterday, they greet each other with a handshake. I've been in England studying for about 5 months, and I don't know. I can't count the times I've done this and not gotten a response. They don't shake hands like we do here. It's part of that British reserve. They do push and shove in the grocery store, I understand, but they don't shake hands as readily as we do. And that's one of the things, it's just a trivial example, but it's one of the kinds of things that makes them a different people. They have a different way of life. And that reflects something, I think, about the kind of people they are and the kind of people we are. Another example is, I understand, in the in Africa, it's fairly common for two men to walk down the street in public holding hands. That means something very, very different in Philadelphia than it does in Africa. And that's one. That's again a trivial example, but it says something about the differences between the two cultures. If a culture is a particular way of life, it includes those kind of little gestures and the way we interact with one another beyond the words we use. We interact with one another all kinds of ways. Not only that, but we can also, and perhaps more importantly, say that in many cases, rituals and ceremonies express what a people aspires to be, not always express what a people is, the way they actually live, but rites and ceremonies, public rituals, very often express the kind of people we aspire to be. Again, you can use if we can use ritual in an expansive sense, which is fairly common among sociologists and anthropologists, we can talk about the rituals of election year. Okay, there's a repeated pattern. We go through the same kinds of things. Certainly, you know, an inauguration is a ritual, and it says something about the kind of people we are, as does the entire election process. It says something about the kind of civilization we have, the kind of polity we have. And that's true of the sacraments as well. The sacraments are rites, and we can also say that they're symbols. And I'm using symbol here in, I guess, more of a sociological than a strictly theological sense. But when I say that the sacraments are symbols, I mean that they are they crystallize in kind of a manageable, you know, easy to see form what we aspire to be. People can become symbols to us as individuals. If you're training for the ministry and you want to, you aspire to preach like D. James Kennedy, Kennedy becomes like a symbol to you. He's the standard by which you evaluate your progress. Am I living up to that? Or if you aspire to be a writer and you want to write with the wit and the vigor of G.K. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton becomes something of a symbol by which you evaluate your own efforts and your own progress. Documents can be symbols in this sense. In fact, in church, in theology, the creeds are frequently called symbols. And I think in something like this sense, they're standards of measurement by which we measure orthodoxy and heresy. Political documents can be symbols in this sense. Abraham Lincoln certainly treated the Declaration of Independence as a symbol of what we aspire to be as a people. He looked at the Declaration, and he looked at American reality, and he looked at the Declaration, looked at the reality, and this doesn't match up. We're not living up to what we say we are. And what we're supposed to be is embodied in this document. We say all men are created equal, but we don't act like it. Okay. For you Southerners, I'm not intending to defend Lincoln. I'm just giving an example. If there are any Southerners here, I'm married to a Southerner, so I don't talk in glowing terms about Lincoln around the house. So I have to do it here. As symbols, the sacraments play the same kind of role. They express and embody who we aspire to be as a people. And let me give just some kind of random examples of how this works. Let's start with baptism, and I need to just take a very brief couple of examples. let me take the ones I didn't do this morning. Baptism is death. We die and rise again in Christ, and in the ancient church liturgies, this was baptismal liturgies, this was expressed by the renunciation of the devil and all his works and all his ways, a renunciation of the world in baptism. And even if that's not part of our baptismal liturgy, it's part of the meaning of baptism. That we've died to an old life, we've died to an old world, so that we can live to a new world, to a new way of life. And by world, of course, in the New Testament does not mean the physical creation. We believe as Christians that the physical creation is good. And so we're not dying to that, to the world in that sense. We're dying to the world in the sense of a way of life, a human culture that's organized on the principle of unbelief, that's organized around rebellion against God. And when we're, those of us who are baptized have implicitly, even if we haven't ever thought about it, we've implicitly said, that's past. We're not part of that world anymore. We're part of another world. We're citizens of another city. We're part of another way of life. And as the baptism then gives us a standard by which we evaluate our progress. Are we living up to our baptism, or are we living up to the renunciation of the world that's implicit in our baptism, or are we once baptized going back and embracing the world? That's one example of how the sacrament of baptism is a standard by which we evaluate how we're doing as a people. Another example, and this kind of works in the other direction. We can ask the question not only whether our practices and our beliefs measure up to what the rite implies, but we can also ask whether the rite reflects, whether what we do in baptism reflects what we say we believe. And here I'm directing my comments to Baptists, and if those Baptists among us, I certainly don't want to be offensive, but I do mean to be provocative, and ask this question. Does adult baptism or believer's baptism express what we say we believe about God's choice of the weak and foolish of the world whom God has chosen to confound the wise? If we're just going to baptize to bring into the church and to embrace those as members of the church, those who can give a profession of faith, those who can articulate their faith in a particular way, is that consistent with what we say we believe about the scope of God's mercy, okay, about the scope of God's care? Is the rite really expressing what we say we believe, that the weak and foolish things of the world have been chosen to confound the wise? In my mind, as an advocate of paedobaptism, I see an inconsistency there. We say that we believe that the weak and foolish are embraced and chosen specifically, and yet the weak and foolish, the most weak and foolish among us, are not embraced within the rite of baptism in an anti-paedo-baptist view. That's something for your contemplation. The Eucharist, or the Lord's Supper, also is a standard of measurement to tell us how we're doing. It's a symbol. And I'm going to use Eucharist and Lord's Supper kind of interchangeably. Eucharist is less common term in the Reformed tradition, but it's a perfectly good word. It simply means thanksgiving, and that's certainly part of what we do as we gather at the Lord's table. Well, what does the Eucharist tell us about the kind of people we're supposed to be? Again, just a few scattered examples that I don't have time to develop. The Eucharist is a communal event. It's the church gathered together in the presence of God to fellowship with God and with one another. And this, I think, is a radical, it's a radical critique, it's a radical challenge to the individualistic emphasis that's so prevalent in American culture and the individualistic emphasis that has come full force into the church. As American Christians, we're much more apt to think in terms of Jesus and me. Me alone with Jesus in the garden. Okay, I'm not at all denying that we're personally have personal individual fellowship with God through Jesus Christ. But equally important in the New Testament is this horizontal dimension, and that's expressed in the Eucharist. Are we living up to that? Do we really express that in the way we live together? Are we really communities where we recognize that we're members of one another? It's not just me and Jesus, but it's me and you and they in Jesus. Okay. The Eucharist challenges the individualistic strain that's entered into our churches. The Eucharist also challenges the tendency to be world-renouncing in the sense of material renouncing. There's a kind of a strain of Gnosticism or dualism within within the evangelical tradition, where the creation is not a means for communion with God, but the Eucharist shows us that that's precisely the case. That the material world is good, and is given us specifically so that we can commune with God and receive the world with thanksgiving, with Eucharist. And the Eucharist, the celebration of the Eucharist, challenges us constantly with our tendency to think of the world as evil or bad, because, you know, we're eating bread and we're drinking wine, I think. Okay. But it challenges the kind of implicit Gnosticism that can enter into American evangelical spirituality. It also challenges our preoccupation with self-fulfillment. The Eucharist, or the Lord's Supper, makes the sacrifice of Christ central, not in the sense of being a repetition of the sacrifice of Christ, but in the sense of at least being a memorial of Christ's sacrifice, whatever we want to say about the meaning of that term, memorial. But every week that we celebrate the supper, I'm very much an advocate of weekly celebration, as Calvin was, but if we celebrate it every week what is placed right in front of us is the challenge of Jesus Christ in his life, and it puts self-sacrifice right up in front of our faces. And all through the week, we're self-preoccupied, we're looking out for ourselves, we're trying to fulfill ourselves, and every week we're confronted with this rite that tells us this is not the kind of people we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be a self-sacrificing people, a self-denying people, and people who takes up our cross. Okay. Finally, discipline. I'm having trouble spelling. If I misspelled anything, it's fatigue. I will have time for questions at the end, as far as I can tell. In thinking about how discipline shapes the church as a distinct culture or people with a distinct way of life, I've been helped by the work of Philip Reif. Philip Reif is a Jewish sociologist he's at the University of Pennsylvania, I believe, written a couple of books on psychology, on Freud, and a number of essays on general culture and sociology. What Reif claims that cultures are based on prohibitions. Cultures are based on saying no. And again, a picture helps me, and maybe it'll help you. Let's say that this represents, this amoeba shape represents human behavior. And human behavior is pretty shapeless. Humans behave in all kinds of ways. But human conduct, human behavior in and of itself, doesn't make a culture. If everybody's doing what's right in his own eyes, we're not doing things in common, which is what makes a culture a culture, that we have a common way of life. In order to have a culture, Reif says, you've got to say no. You've got to draw lines. You've got to say, well, can't do that. And you can't do that. And you can't do that. This is the realm in which you can act. The culture is founded, shape is given to human behavior by saying no. Okay. And Reif also goes on to say that these boundaries are reinforced and protected by what he calls priesthoods. And by that he means, he's talking about it in a sociological sense, but usually some kind of authorities who are given the task of making sure that these boundaries stay in place. That if somebody goes from in here to out here, there's some consequence to that. When somebody says no, and he says, why not? The priesthood steps in and says, you can't do that and still be part of us. You're outside now. Okay. And the priesthoods also, in Reif's view, make sure that the thou shalt nots, the term that he uses, the thou shalt nots of the culture are passed on to another generation and become and shape that generation's living. cultures are founded on the primacy of prohibition or interdiction, on the primacy of saying no. Our culture, Reif says, is based on the primacy of possibility. And by that he means that we're living in a situation where every possibility, every possibility of human behavior is an open possibility. When someone says, thou shalt not, the answer is, why not? He says, you don't have a culture that way. What you have is an anti-culture. What you have is the shapeless mass of human behavior, but you don't have a common way of life. Now, Reif, of course, is talking about culture generally. I think this, is a helpful way to think about the way that the culture of the church is shaped. The church's behavior, the behavior of the members of the church, is based on some thou shalt not. Also some thou shalt do, certainly. We want to give positive, the Bible gives positive commands, but the Bible also gives negative commands. It says you can't do that and remain part of us. And if you cross over that line, you're outside. You're in the world now. You're not one of us. Okay. You can't backbite. You can't gossip and be a member of this community. That's not the way we behave. There's boundaries beyond which we're not allowed to go. And it's also true, I think, and helpful to say that the church has priesthoods in Reif's sense, that there are leaders and elders who are given a special calling and a special task to enforce these boundaries, to make sure that the shape that our churches have doesn't, just collapse into shapelessness, so that we have a common way of life and a way of life that's based on God's thou shalt nots and God's thou shalts. This is true of elders particularly and pastors and leaders in the church, but according to the New Testament, we're all priests. And we all have this task and calling to guard the boundaries of the church. We all have guard duty in the house of God. The book of Hebrews makes this point several times, where it says that we should make sure that none among us has an evil, unbelieving heart, a heart that is hardened. That's not just the pastor's responsibility. In some particular way, it is the pastor's responsibility. Leaders are given responsibilities, not everyone is. But every member of the church is a priest in this sense, and every member of the church is called to encourage good works, to encourage the fulfillment of the thou shalts, and to rebuke and discourage violations of the thou shalt nots. And what I'm referring to here is Matthew 18, where Jesus gives us instructions for the New Testament general priesthood about how to deal with people who step outside these boundaries. G.K. Chesterton said of Christianity in general that the problem with Christianity is not that it's been tried and found wanting. It's not been tried and found unworkable. The problem is that Christianity has been found difficult and left untried. And I think that's perhaps especially true in the church, of the practice of this kind of mutual discipline of one another. We have all kinds of excuses for not following what Jesus says here. For it's very uncomfortable to go and rebuke a brother, to tell a brother he sinned. It's very hard to confront, and we found that difficult and left it untried. It's not that we've tried it and found that it doesn't work. But Jesus' commandments are clear, and it's a responsibility of every member of the church to be involved in rebuking, encouraging, in building one another up through this mutual discipline. I'm going to end right there and see if there are any questions or comments. The question for the sake of the tape is give some more specific content to my claim that there's an implicit Gnosticism within evangelicalism. I guess what I have in mind here is ideas that a Gnostic dualistic idea that the material world is somehow less good than the world of the mind or the internal world of the spirit. And that's not a Christian view. The Christian view is that the whole creation is good, and that includes our bodies. And I fail trying to think of specific examples, I would recommend, although it's kind of neo-Orthodox, but can't remember the guy's name, but there's a book called Against the Protestant Gnostics. He's basically neo-Orthodox, but he's challenging liberalism primarily, but I think what he says has is very helpful for evaluating evangelical Christians as well. And also has the great advantage and great honor of reviving the practice of the ancient church of starting book titles with the word against. Right. God in the Wasteland is the second one. And the first one is, that's really where he comes out more with more strongly by saying that the problem is worldliness, I think. But the first one is, help me here. The subtitle is Whatever Happened to Evangelical Theology, but I can't remember the first. No Place for Truth, thank you. Yes. Well, I wouldn't, I'm not sure how to put that into the diagram. I would say this about it, though, if I can just speak to it rather than try to picture it. I think we have to insist on a kind of a duality in the New Testament teaching of the kingdom. That the kingdom embraces all things, that Jesus Christ is Lord of all. but at the same time, I think we have to say that in a peculiar sense, in a specific sense, the church is the people that will inherit the kingdom. And I think in the New Testament sometimes does use kingdom language to describe the church. So in some sense, there's a centrality to the people of God and to the distinctive ministries of the church. That's how I understand the New Testament. But without denying that the kingdom of God is also an all-embracing reality. Ephesians, at the end of Ephesians 1, I think we see something of this duality. At the end, I'm just going to break in the middle. Verse 19 says, "These are in accordance with the working of the strength of his might, which he brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion and every name that is named." King Jesus is king of all, not only in this age, but also in the age to come. "And he's put all things in subjection under his feet and gave him his head over all things." Gave him his head over all things. Okay, he's ruler over all. His reign extends to every, you know, there isn't an inch of the universe that Jesus doesn't claim as his own. But then the next phrase says, "He is head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all." There's a kind of double fullness here. There's a fullness, Jesus fills all in all through his spirit, but the church is the fullness of his filling. And I think there's some tension there that I've not been able to get by, and I think it's just there in the New Testament, that there's a centrality to the church, and yet the kingdom, in a sense, the church is the kingdom, the first form of the kingdom, and yet the kingdom of God stretches to everything. I've tried to express this in my book, The Kingdom and the Power. I'm not sure if I succeeded in resolving that, but I think that there's just a duality that I don't think is reducible to a simple. Well, that's part of what I'm trying to do, and I didn't really bring it out quite as much. But yeah, I think in a certain sense, you can say every culture has these kinds of characteristics. They have a certain language, a certain way of ordering reality, certain kinds of rites and ceremonies and gestures, a certain governmental structure, and a certain moral order. So yeah, that's the way I'm trying to think about it. Yeah. Right, that's what I'm saying. And, you know, this again, that's what I'm saying, that the first form of Christian culture is in the church, I think. But the church's mission is not just to, you know, to talk to each other, but to proclaim and to try to persuade the world, for example, that the Christian language is the true language and the Christian story is the true story, to try to convince the nations to see themselves in service to the furtherance of this history, and not see themselves as the be all and end all of history. As an example of this again, overly stressing this, but I don't think this is at all a utopian kind of thing to say that the church is seeking to have the culture that exists there embodied in the world.